offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series. As always, this is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I'm coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. It's another beautiful Thursday evening, and it gives me great pleasure to join you all again on the next episode of the Gita series, where we go through the verses of the Bhagavad Gita in the context of Swami's message and try to imbibe the beautiful and profound message that Lord Krishna gave Arjuna 5,000 years or more ago. As always, let's begin with a short introduction of what we covered last week. We are still in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. We covered verses 63, 64 and 65 last week. And we started off with verses 62 and 63 actually, because they are connected in a sense, because there Krishna explains how when the objects of the world and desires capture our fancy, we are eventually led to ruin. When one constantly contemplates or gives mind space, if I could put it that way, to a desire or to a desire towards an object or a situation, it leads to attachment to that particular idea. And we discuss in detail how that happens. That attachment becomes a desire, and from that desire is born anger. And anger is born, or agitation happens when the desire remains unfulfilled. The verse 63, he continues with that same flow of idea where he says, when one is agitated or angry, it leads to delusion. And a deluded mind then loses memory. We spoke of how when he says memory here, it refers to the learnings and the past experience that we eventually or invariably depend on to make decisions. So when the memory is lost, one loses the ability to discriminate. And without discrimination, one is led to ruin. In verse number 64, Krishna had contrasted this entire description that he had given with a person who has self-control, right? Who acts with self-control. And this is a description of someone who is, all of the description that we had till this point was a description of someone who is led by his likes and dislikes, that is raga and dvesha. But one who has controlled the senses and does not blindly follow the raga and dvesha is able to attain serenity, right? That's what Krishna says in verse number 64. The verse 65 we did cover last week, but I promised that we'll go a little more into detail this week. So we'll start with that and then go on to the verses that follow. Till the 64th verse, Krishna spoke about the importance of self-control and control of the senses and the mind. And the background for that starts with someone who has placed his or her focus on something other than worldly benefits, and in fact, even heaven and hell, right? That's right in the beginning of the second chapter. This is how we must live our lives, with a focus on the higher purpose or higher goal of life, right? This is what Krishna had made it very, very clear in the beginning. But actions we still have to do. There is no escape from actions. So the whole discourse till now is, how must actions be done? So Krishna explains that it must be done as a duty without craving for any specific benefits. And how does one do this? Through the wise use of one's sense organs. So when we use the word control, we often mistake it to be suppression or curbing of the senses. But control means the ability to use judiciously. So when Krishna says control of the senses, he means one is in a state where one is the authority over the senses. He means that one is in a state where he is able to direct the senses according to one's purpose, right? Always, whenever the word control is used, I think this has to be kept in mind. And the analogy which I always go back to saying is, when you say that I have control over my car or over my motorbike, it does not mean the car and the motorbike is locked up in the garage. That is not control. When I say I have control over my car, it means I can drive my car right into the traffic and ensure I don't harm myself and harm anybody else around. Right? That's what is control. So when Krishna uses the word control of the senses and control of the mind over and over again, it does not mean locking up the senses and the mind out completely from the world, but being able to use it judiciously, right? The person who has control chooses when to use them and when to listen to them and when to ignore them. So that has to be always kept in mind. So Krishna says, one who has such control will attain serenity. Prasadam adhigacchati, he had said. That was in the 64th verse. The 65th verse, which we went through the last time, speaks of the relationship between tranquility, wisdom, and happiness. In fact, this whole portion about Stita Prajna is a description of how one who has wisdom will also be tranquil, right? Because the word Stita Prajna or the phrase Stita Prajna itself is used even for a person who is always calm and collected, right? So Krishna says, Prasade, when the mind is tranquil, Sarva Dukkhanam Hanihi, the destruction of all sorrow, Asya Upajayate, occurs in him. If we look at our own lives and if we observe how we have led our lives, we all have gone through periods of tranquility. It's like, not that we have never seen tranquility. When we sleep or when we go on a vacation probably, there are no pressing duties to attend to. And because of that, we are tranquil. Or just some phases in life where everything seems to be going smooth. I'm sure even the person who's had the worst in life will have periods of life where they can turn to and say that everything was going through smoothly and I was comparatively serene during that period. Or any period where there's nothing, no pressing worry that is taking us. We are going for our work and everything is going smoothly. The boss likes us. The colleagues are behaving rightly with us. A period where everything is going smoothly, right? But this is a tranquility that comes because of the absence of any disturbance, right? I hope you understand where this comes from. This tranquility occurs because of the absence of disturbance. And if we observe our lives, invariably, this is the tranquility that we are so hardly trying to achieve in our everyday life. We are constantly striving to attain this kind of tranquility. For example, we study very hard, we get a good degree, all with the hope that this will secure my future, right? When we start earning a lot of money, we will still, you know, we'll be thinking about saving for the future, or we'll be thinking about the pension plan. Why? Because tomorrow a need should not disturb me and my family. Or we invest in insurance, or sometimes we network with very powerful people, all with the idea that tomorrow if there is a need, tomorrow if there is a disturbance, I can turn to these people, I can turn to this savings, I can turn to this particular person, right? A very funny thing happened a couple of months ago where one of my friends from the school finally tracked me down. I had completely lost touch with all of them after I came to Swami's college. So after many, many years, one of them tracked me down and they said, we are planning a reunion and you should come and join us. And then they said, we're forming a WhatsApp group and you should be part of that. So in trying to convince me to join that group, this friend of mine was saying, you know what, one of our classmates has become a MLA or a member of the Legislative Assembly. You know, it's considered to be a position of power in Indian society. So he said, you know, one of our classmates has become an MLA. It's very good to keep in contact. It will be useful later. Why? Because we always have this idea that tomorrow if I'm in a crisis, tomorrow if I'm in a situation, you can turn to these people of authority. So we are constantly trying to maintain our tranquility or serenity by controlling all of these things which are outside of us, right? And that is what we are generally doing. We are trying to constantly do this of ensuring that nothing disturbs me and I can be tranquil. But Krishna is talking of a tranquility which, when attained, will make all sorrows vanish. He says, Sarva Dukkhanam Hanihi. He doesn't say the sources of sorrow will vanish. That is what we are trying to do. We are trying to negate the sources of sorrow. But sorrow caused by different sources will vanish. That is what Krishna is promising. And as Swami had explained, sorrow can be of three types. Adhyatmika, Adi Bhautika and Adi Daivika. And this is what I messed up last week. I couldn't recollect all the three of them, right? So these are the three sources of sorrow. The sources of sorrow will not vanish. The sources of sorrow will not go away or will not be suppressed as we are trying to do, but the sorrow itself will vanish. For example, Adhyatmika is sorrow caused by ourselves, our body and our mind. We discussed about it, how this comes about. The body and the mind remain, but the sorrow will vanish. It is not that we'll give up the body or we'll become mindless. That'll eventually happen, but even when with the body and the mind, the sorrow vanishes. Similarly, when we say Adi Bhautika, the sorrow which is Adi Bhautika is caused by people who are around us, our colleagues, our neighbors, friends, our family, right? It's not that we have to run away from all of these people to find happiness, but these people will stop troubling us, or rather, whatever they do will stop troubling us. We will be in a state where whatever they do will not disturb us, right? You don't need to run away from them in to ensure that we are peaceful. Similarly, when we talk about Adi Devika, it is the sorrow caused by factors which are completely beyond us, which are natural, disasters, calamities. So it's not like all of these will vanish or we'll have an insurance which every time covers us when there's a disaster. But the sorrow that arises out of these changing things, these Adi Daivika, Adi Bhautika, or Adi Atmika, will no more bother us. So when there is no sorrow in this manner, the mind is ever happy and cheerful. Prasanna Chetaso Hi. Because the mind is in a happy state this way, Ashu, soon, Buddhihi Pari Avatishtate. Discrimination is well established. This is what Krishna had said in that verse that we covered last week. So here is again a very beautiful and very important myth buster of sorts, if I could put it that way. Because generally we think that the purpose of life itself is to be happy and nothing more. So anything that makes us happy, that is what we have to do, right? That's the idea we generally have. It is true to some extent, right? Because as I've mentioned this many, many times before, Swami would often use that phrase called man is Ananda Pipasi. He's constantly striving and desiring and craving for happiness and bliss. And that is how he carries on his life. So it is true to an extent, but even tranquility leading to happiness is only to prepare the mind. Prepare the mind for what? So that the buddhi is well established, so that the spiritual discrimination, so that the spiritual wisdom is well established in the mind. Even happiness is only to prepare the mind for that. So all these are so very beautifully and profoundly interconnected and also necessary. If my discrimination is perfect, but I'm going to be unhappy always, then something is wrong somewhere. If I'm happy always, but I'm not in control of myself, let us say if I'm in a state of high, taking some narcotics or something like that, yes, I will be in a state of euphoria, I will be in a state of bliss, but there my buddhi is completely switched off. I have no control over myself. So all of these is important. So this is a very beautiful description of a spiritual person, right? We all are doing sadhana. How do we know that we are progressing? We will be able to more and more easily do our duty without expectations. That is one of the signs. Distractions will reduce in our lives. That's another sign. We will be more tranquil. That's another very important sign. Worries will reduce. Happiness will increase. And all this will in turn lead to more self-discrimination and more self-control. It's almost like a cycle which, you know, each one strengthens the other. And any of these could be parameters to see whether we are progressing in the spiritual path. And any of these things can be taken up as spiritual goals, or at least, you know, goals which are a little more higher than purely worldly goals. Saying that I want to be more tranquil. I want to ensure that the disturbances around don't trouble me more. Or I want to ensure that I'm able to do my duty come what may. I may be rewarded with the right kind of results. I might be rewarded by people praising me. even if that does not happen, am I able to constantly do my duty diligently? So any of these can be used to see whether we are progressing. Any of these can be kept as goals for us on this spiritual path, right? And all this must lead to steadiness. That is the catchword, right? That which comes and goes is useless. That must come and stay, at least stay for a little longer, right? That steadiness is the catchword, because all this, I think, we will go through some extent. As I said, we can look back into our lives and say, you know, these were the periods I was tranquil and these were the periods I was happy, or I led a simple life, but it all comes and goes. Our discrimination too, like that, comes and goes. Our tranquility and our happiness, all of that comes and goes. And that is why Krishna reiterates this in the next step, where he says that that focus, that ability to, as Swami would use the word nishta, right? In Sanskrit, there's a beautiful word which says the ability to stay firm on that thing where we have placed our mind, right? So that is the next verse where we will go through, which is verse number 66. As always, it is rendered very beautifully and clearly by Brother Shyam, one of our alumnus. We'll listen to that. I'll give you a very brief meaning after that, and then we'll discuss in detail about this verse. This is verse number 66 from chapter 2 of the Bhagavad Gita.
Nasti buddhira yuktasya na cha yuktasya bhavana na cha bhavayata shantihi ashantasya kutasukham.
For the unsteady, there is no wisdom, and there is no meditation for the unsteady man. And for an unmeditative man, there is no peace. How can there be happiness for one without peace? So that's the meaning for verse number 66. Krishna uses here the word ayukta for a person who is, you could say, opposite of a sthita prajna. Actually, the word ayukta is, we can use it for all of us, or rather for any regular person who is leading life guided by raga and dvesha, likes and dislikes. One who does not have sense control, who is still thrown off balance from the reverses that one faces, can be referred to as an ayukta, right? That's the word Krishna uses here. He says, nasti buddhihi ayuktasya. For a person who is an ayukta, there is no buddhi. And as I've mentioned before, the word buddhi has multiple meanings, right? It can be used for discrimination, for regular intelligence that we have to use constantly in our life, for normal discrimination between right and wrong, good and bad. But it can also be used for spiritual discrimination. Right in the beginning of the second chapter, Krishna had defined a wise man as one who knows the difference between sat and asat, truth and that which is not the truth, right? This is the spiritual buddhi. So we can say Krishna is referring to this buddhi in this particular verse. So he says, nasti buddhihi ayuktasya. An ayukta will never be able to attain that wisdom. Not only that, Krishna goes on to say, nacha ayuktasya bhavana. And also, for the ayukta, there is no focus. The word bhavana also means meditation. We'll come to that in a short bit. But it also means the ability to stay focused on something. So the one who does not have control over the senses, an ayukta, does not have buddhi or wisdom. Even if one does not have wisdom, even if one has wisdom, as I said, there are ways by which one can become wise, one can attain that wisdom. But even if that person happens to get that wisdom, he cannot become a sthita prajna, because the wisdom will come and go. That which comes and goes is pretty much pointless. If my wisdom is going to constantly come and go, then I have no control over it. I can never choose when I will have it. Tomorrow, let's say my business tanks, or the stock market crashes, or I lose my job, or I lose a beloved person, and then I will suddenly wonder, oh God, where is all that wisdom? I read so many books, I read the Bhagavad Gita, I heard so many discourses, but where is that wisdom, right? Because if the wisdom comes and goes, we will not have it at our disposal when we need it the most. There is no steadiness, there is no focus, right? And then he goes on to say, Nacha abhavayataha shantihi. The one who does not have that ability to focus or to hold on to that can never be at peace. Ashantasya kutas sukham. When one does not have peace, how can one be happy? That's how that verse ends. As I said, the word bhavana also means meditation. It means being focused. It means being steady. It also means meditation, right? So taking it as to mean meditation, I think we can look at this shloka in a slightly different way, and it can also be connected to something that Krishna had said earlier in the chapter. So first Krishna says, if one is in quest of buddhi or yoga buddhi, as Krishna had said in the beginning of the chapter, one must control the mind and thereby the senses. And then he says, without this control, there can be no bhavana or focus. The word bhavana being translated as meditation is something which is used by many, many translators and many commentators too. Now, what is it to be contemplative or meditative? A very basic thing. I'm not talking about a very philosophical understanding of meditation, but what is it to be contemplative or meditative? The senses are all the time drawing us outward. And if we allow our raga and dvesha to endlessly guide our lives, even lifetimes are not enough to satisfy the mind, right? The senses will constantly keep going outward. New products will keep coming in the market. New technology will keep coming. New gadgets will keep coming. It is endless. There is no way you can satisfy. As Professor Venkatraman would always say, there are two kinds of desires. There are desires of the body and desires of the mind. Desires of the body can be satisfied because the body has an inbuilt mechanism to say that I've had enough, right? Either you will puke out or either you'll pass out because you've eaten too much or drunk too much or whatever it is. But the desires of the mind are very, very difficult to fulfill, right? So any number of lifetimes can be spent if we are constantly going to follow the senses guided by the raga and dvesha, and they're constantly going outward, right? But at some point, we must stop and ask some very, very fundamental questions. And this we'll have to do it ourselves. Am I really feeling happiness doing all this? What is the purpose of all this? Right? We'll have to stop and ask these very fundamental questions. And we will never look within contemplatively if we do not give a break to this constantly running senses that are running outward. Right? And if you look at it, that is the very purpose of, be it something like a prayer session, going on pilgrimages, going to a temple or a Sai center, or even sitting in the altar of your house. And that is also the reason why simplicity or austerity is a feature of all of these places, pilgrim centers, Sai centers, and your altar room, and in a temple. We always emphasize on simplicity and austerity when we talk about these places. Because you are taking a break from constant and continuous sense gratification so that you can go within, so that you can turn within contemplatively. So even for this simple contemplation, a certain amount of simplicity, or in other words, control and self-restraint, is very, very important, right? And the other prerequisite for meditation or contemplation, again, I'm saying very, very simplistically, not very philosophically. I think we will all be able to relate to this. What is it that we require to be in solitude? If I cannot stand my own company, I cannot be alone, right? As simple as that. If I have to be alone, if I have to be in solitude, to a certain extent, I should be able to enjoy my own company. And here, when I say solitude, it does not mean being alone, being physically alone, being by ourselves. Right now in our modern lives, you know, we have so many, many gadgets to fill our lives. that we, most of us will probably prefer to be alone in that manner. We will probably watch something on YouTube, we'll watch something on our televisions, or we'll listen to music, or we'll keep browsing the internet, or we'll spend hours together on social media. All of this being by ourselves. We could be locked up in our house or room and we can do this. This is not solitude, right? This is just being alone to ourselves. This is not solitude. I'm only physically alone in this manner, but I need the company of people through social media, through all of these gadgets, through the videos that I'm watching or whatever it is, right? I am not being alone. I'm just filling my need for company through all of these gadgets. Why am I saying this? Let us say that I have to interact in person physically with another person. If I have to do that, I have to be there in front of that person. Who I am and what I am is laid out in front of that person to a great extent. Yes, I can conceal all of the nonsense which goes on in my mind by not revealing it. I can be a different person that I show in front of that person. That is a different thing altogether. But all said and done, to a certain extent, I need to be there in front of that person, right? But when I interact through social media, I can, to a much larger extent, conceal my personality and who I am from the persons or the people I'm interacting with, right? That's quite an obvious thing. So being alone that way with all these gadgets as company is, in fact, much, much further from being in solitude, right? That is why they say that the interaction with social media and the younger generation is leading to much, much more cases of loneliness and depression coming out of loneliness than before, right? So this is not solitude, because solitude by definition is we being comfortable with who we are, right? That is the definition. If I can be in solitude, it means to a certain extent, I am all right with who I am. What do I really mean by this, me being comfortable with who I am? When I crave to become wealthy, when I crave for a certain position, when I crave for a certain status in life, it means that I am not happy with my present. I am not happy with where I am in my life right now. See, if I have a desire for a big house, it suggests that I am unhappy with my present house where I am living, the present small house, a simple dwelling where I am in, right? In other words, when I desire or crave for something, I am inadvertently, without so much speaking it out, saying that I will be happy only when I am me plus that object. I will only be happy when I am me plus that status. And more the craving, more deeply I crave for that status or for that object or for the fulfillment of that desire, more this idea that I am unhappy with who I am right now, me minus that object, me minus that ambition, right? So to be contemplative, to be able to turn within, we need solitude, and for that, we must be slightly, at least to a certain extent, comfortable with ourselves. That is why Krishna had said in this description, in his description of the Stita Prajna, in the very first verse, when Arjuna asked who is a Stita Prajna, one of the first things that Krishna says is, Atmanyeva Atmana Tushtaha, one who is able to be satisfied in oneself. The most perfect state is being completely absorbed in the self. I don't need anything else. I'm completely in the atmic bliss. That's the ultimate, right? And that will eventually come. But even for you and me, a good start is trying to practice this solitude. And for that, a little bit of control of the senses becomes mandatory, or the starting point, right? That is why, you know, Swami has given us all of these tools, the Sai Center, a temple, an ashram. And when we go to these places, yes, everything will definitely not be to our liking. Yeah, we would love a more comfortable bed when we come to the ashram. And, oh, we would like to sit somewhere else when we go to the center. Oh, why are these restrictions there in this particular samiti? But these have been created not to extend our running behind our ragas and dveshas, we should keep in mind that we are coming to these places. Yes, everything will not be to my liking, but that is precisely the point. This is not meant to purely satisfy and feed your raga and dvesha. This is meant to make you step back a little and say that, all right, this is working for me, right? That's the whole idea. And it is with a contemplative nature or bhavana that one can get peace, right? That's what Krishna had said in that verse. And this is a no-brainer, right? I can be peaceful only when the restlessness ceases. This is as simple as it can get. If I'm always thinking of what I don't have and what I have but I'm scared of losing, how will I ever be peaceful? So I will always be agitated. I want this, I want that. You know, I want to ensure that nothing happens to this. I want to ensure that I don't lose my position, right? So this agitation will never make us be in a state of peace. And if we very honestly examine our lives and we go through all of these emotions, right? There are moments when we are peaceful, there are moments when we are tranquil, there are moments when we are agitated. So if we were to just sit down and examine our lives and examine how, that's why Swami would say, examine each one of your days. There are some days that we are just happy, right? We wake up happy, we go to bed happy, or sometimes at the end of the day, it's just been a peaceful day, right? Or sometimes when you've accomplished something, when you've strived for many, many years to accomplish a task, and you finally accomplish it, right? When we go through that emotion, what is actually happening in our mind? Because at that moment, we are satisfied with what we are at that moment, we find elation or we find a sense of calmness, right? So my sense of self-satisfaction and peace can only become perfect if I'm able to turn within and be satisfied with who I am. And when my mind and senses are not running outward, right? And for that, control of the senses is the starting point. So this is an experience that each one of us can vouch for ourselves, right? Because whenever we are comfortable with who we are is when we find tranquility. And we will constantly be challenged and this state will be disturbed every time something comes in front of us and say, oh, I don't have that. And I'm incomplete without that. Suddenly a new vehicle will come, a new gadget will come and say, oh, I don't have that. And I'm feeling incomplete or I need to have that to be happy, right? So we experience both of these states. So that is why all of this is not something which we cannot relate to. So that is why Krishna says that, you know, this is what is going to give you peace. And if you want this peace, start with control of the senses. And when you control your senses, you will be able to turn within. When you are able to turn within, you can become contemplative, you can become meditative. And the more you're able to become meditative, you will find that there is happiness within and you will be able to fix your mind on that buddhi, right? And finally, the final point, when we are agitated, how can we ever be happy, right? That's what Krishna says. When one is agitated, there can be no happiness. Ashantasya kutas sukham, he says. Even if we are happy, let's say, you know, I've not gone to that tranquility state, but I am happy. You know, there are happiness that we feel every now and then. What is the point if that happiness is going to vanish anytime and we have no control over it? What is the point of such happiness at all? That is why we are in search for two things. Initially I said it's a myth buster that we are after happiness and we always think that we are after happiness. The myth buster is this. Yes, it is almost like the carrot hanging in front of us and we are chasing it. Yes, we are chasing happiness, but without acknowledging it sometimes, we are also searching for happiness that is going to be constant, right? And many times people ask this question, you know, how will the people who are so lost in worldly pleasures ever turn to spirituality? You know, oh, my children are constantly engaged in earning money, and how are they ever going to turn to spirituality? eventually everybody will turn to spirituality only through this means. Because everybody wants happiness and everybody wants to secure that happiness, and eventually one will be so frustrated with happiness that cannot be retained for long enough, and they will turn to the spiritual path or the path of yoga. And what is yoga? Yoga is union with God. And that is why Swami would say, true happiness is only in union with God. So in this quest for happiness, we will eventually turn to union with God, to yoga. And that is again going to be reiterated by Krishna in the next verse, which is the 67th verse. We'll listen to that. I'll give you a short and a brief meaning of that verse, and then we'll discuss about it.
Indriyanam hi charatam yanmano nu vidhiyate tadasya harati prajnam vayurnavamivambhasi.
For the mind which follows in the ways of the wandering senses carries away his discrimination as the wind carries away a boat on the waters. That's verse number 67. The mind that constantly follows the outward going senses, right? We're talking about that. Such a mind cannot concentrate, I think, even on regular work that we are doing. This is again an experience that each one of us have. The beauty of all of these concepts is it is referring to the life experiences that we go through in everyday life. That how many of us can relate to this? You know, when we were students or when we are studying for an exam, there is probably a cricket match going on the TV, or your mother is frying some bhajis and that aroma is coming to you. It is so very difficult to concentrate on your, you know, homework or what you're studying when all of these distractions are around, right? So this is something that we have experienced in our day-to-day life. If to do even a smallly, if you look at it, if to be able to do even our regular work, this kind of control of our senses and focus of the mind is important. I think it's absolutely obvious that when we are looking at something way higher, the spiritual goal, the control of the senses and the concentration are going hand in hand and are mandatory, right? But many, many in the spiritual path miss this very, very simple point. In the name of spirituality, they give a free run to the senses. And always the argument is, I am not the body, and how can the sins of the body touch me, and so I can do anything with the body, or the body can do anything, but you know, it does not affect my spiritual progress. I think this is a very, very wrong idea of the spiritual path, and that is why I feel this entire chapter of Bhagavad Gita, which is also pretty much a summary of the entire Bhagavad Gita, is so very important. Because Krishna started off by speaking about the limitless nature of the self, right? He said, you're not the body which dies and which decays. You're not the body which ages. You're not the body which, you know, does all of these things. You're not the doer. He started off with that phenomenal, esoteric explanation of the nature of the self. But here he also categorically emphasizes on the importance of mind and sense control, and also of doing one's duty based on the body and the relationships of the body, which has been established as temporary. But he says still you have to do your duty and do it in all of these manners, and he explains all of that, right? So this is why this particular chapter is important, because it puts all of these things in perspective. Saying that I'm a spiritual person, saying that I believe in Advaita, saying that I believe that the Atma is who I am, does in no way give us the leeway or the license to give a free run for the senses, right? We have to take control of ourselves. Otherwise, we will be like rudderless ships, is what Krishna is saying here. He says, yat manaha, that mind, indriyanam charatam anuvidhiyate, which moves following the senses, tat, that, asya harati prajnam, robs away knowledge from him. the mind which is constantly following the senses robs away knowledge from the person. Eva, just as Vayuhu Navam Ambasi, the wind does to a boat on the waters. This is a very, very beautiful analogy. Again, another wonderful analogy that Krishna is giving here to explain this particular point. When you, say, leave a small sailboat untethered on the banks, what happens eventually? You know, the wind will carry it away, right? That's the simplest thing which will happen. How does the wind carry this small boat away when it's not tied to an anchor on the banks? It does so with the help of the sails, right? It is the sail that is being used by the wind. But the same sail, if controlled and used well by the person who is sitting in the boat, can use the force of the wind to take you to the destination that you want, right? Similarly, the same senses and the same mind, if controlled and marshaled, can use the world around to reach the goal. But if the person is sleeping in the boat, or let's say he decides that, oh, controlling the sail is too difficult a task and I'm just going to go with the wind, then the same wind or the same world can carry you away, far, far away from the destination, right? And that is why it is very, very important to take control. Here Krishna says, Tat asya harati prajnam. It steals prajna from the person. The mind that is wayward does not allow one to hold on to the prajna even if one happens to find it. You have found a guru, you have come to Swami, and Swami has given us the truth, right? Tat Tvam Asi is the truth, or Prajnanam Brahma is the truth, or I am Atma Brahma is the truth. And the guru can give these truths. The understanding or the theory can be given to you, and you can say that, oh, I've got the prajna. But what steals the prajna away from the person again and again? And this word is constantly used by Krishna. He says, it steals away the wisdom from you. He says, Tat Asya Harati Prajnam. The mind that is constantly chasing the senses, the mind which is constantly trying to satisfy the raga and dvesha, steals the prajna even if you have found it, even if you're lucky enough to come to a guru, even if you're lucky enough to come face to face with the avatar and receive the wisdom. If you do not ensure that you hold on to it through all of these processes that Krishna has spoken here, it will steal the knowledge from you even though you hold it in your hand, right? So the same point is again reiterated in the next verse. I think we'll go to the next verse. We'll listen to that. I'll give you a brief meaning of that. Because all of these verses are, in a sense, connected and also a summary of whatever Krishna has been speaking about in the entire chapter where he speaks specifically about the nature of the sthita prajna.
Tasmadhyasya mahabaho nigrihitani sarvashah indriyani indriyarthebhyah tasya prajna pratishthita.
Therefore, O mighty armed Arjuna, his knowledge is steady whose senses are completely restrained from sense objects. Again, here is another verse that ends with the phrase, Tasya Prajna Pratishtita. Such a person's wisdom is steady. So Krishna summarizes the past few verses in this particular verse. He says, Mahabaho, O mighty armed one, which is Arjuna, he says, Tasmat, therefore, Yasya Nigrihitani Sarvashaha, for he who has completely controlled Indriyani, the sense organs, Indriya Artebhyaha, from the objects that attract them, Tasya Prajna Pratishtita, such a person's wisdom is steady. So this is how it started, and this is a beautiful summary of that entire thing, that finally it all comes down to the ability to rein in the senses, the ability to pull the mind back, and we spoke about what that control is. It is not completely shutting it off. It is not completely saying that I will not see anything, I will not hear anything, but the ability to choose and say that this is the signal from the senses that I accept, and this is what I choose to ignore. of course, the next verse very beautifully and very cryptically Krishna puts across this again. We'll come to that eventually. But this is what is the final most important practical point that Krishna is saying, that how do you ensure that your buddhi is steady? You have to control your mind, you have to control your senses. How do you go about controlling the mind and the senses? And all of that has been explained. But I think one thing that we can keep in mind is that this discourse, whatever we are going through, is being given to Arjuna. And Arjuna is a phenomenal person in general, right? If you read the Mahabharata, the character of Arjuna is a simply superb character, right? Krishna spoke about the importance of focus, bhavana. And in the Mahabharata, there are many, many episodes that speak of the enormous focus and concentration that Arjuna had displayed on many, many occasions, right? Not only that, if you look at Arjuna and the other Pandavas, unlike the sons of Dhritarashtra, the Kauravas, they have lived a pretty much simple life, right? They were born in a forest, they were brought up in the forest, till the point they eventually go to Hastinapura, right? So they are not somebody who has always been in luxury and in opulence. They have led, for many, many years, led simple lives, right? So in that sense, Arjuna is a person who has enormous focus. Arjuna is a person who has enormous self-control too, right? Because he is spoken of as a person who has controlled his sleep. That's one of the names of Arjuna, Guda Kesha. We had spoken about it. The one who has complete control over his sleep. So he does have a certain amount of control over his body and senses. He has led a simple life, and in the simple life he has led a happy life, which means that, you know, he's not completely a slave to his senses, and also he has displayed enormous focus. Still, Krishna is giving him this discourse. It could only mean two things, that what it requires for attaining the ultimate is so much more. That is why even somebody like Arjuna needed a discourse like this. But the other way of looking at it is what Krishna, Swami had told in the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita itself, where Swami said, Arjuna is a calf, the Vedanta is the cow, and Krishna is the Gopala who is milking the cow, right? And the Gopala never milks the cow for the calf. The calf can help itself. The milking is always for the others, right? So all of this, we can say, is for our benefit. And that is something that you have to keep in mind. Please let us not get into a discussion of, do we really need the milk the cow gives? And is it really suitable for our health? And let's not get into that veganism debate. This is something that we can understand. And that's why Swami always gives this debate. And I always think that probably when the next avatar comes much later, these analogies will not be suitable, because we would have moved away from some of these practices, right? Milking a cow and all of that might be alien to us. But this is all contextual, because Swami is giving all the analogies and using all the analogies which we can relate to, which we have seen, which we have grown up looking at and going through in life, right? But either way, whether the level that Arjuna had reached was not good enough, or it is because we need this discourse that Krishna is giving, one thing that we can say for sure is this is a complete all-round explanation of what the spiritual path is. And that is why going through the Gita is a triune pilgrimage, right? Because Krishna speaks about the ultimate truth of the Atman, right? As I said, that's how the chapter starts. Then he speaks about the importance of karma. And he has also mentioned the need for being attached to God. So it covers jnana, karma and bhakti. And in the past few verses, there are also references to meditation. In fact, there's going to be a complete chapter on dhyana or meditation later. So very, very beautifully, Krishna has connected all of this together. And probably when we summarize the entire second chapter, which I feel we should do and spend some time on that, we will get a complete bird's eye view of whatever Krishna has covered. And we could say that this second chapter is a very brief synopsis of what we must look for when we are a sadhaka, when we are on the spiritual path, right? And that's why this is a very, very beautiful chapter. And needless to say, the entire work is so beautiful. And there is no differentiation between karma, bhakti and jnana and all that is required to take up to these. Right? And that is why this is such a beautiful chapter, such a beautiful work in general. We still have a little bit of time. I have 10 minutes more. I think we have enough time to go through the next verse through, next verse 2, which is verse number 69, which is a very simple but beautiful cryptical verse. We'll listen to that and we'll discuss about it before we conclude this week's show.
Yanisha sarva bhutanam tasyam jagarti samyami yasyam jagrati bhutani sanisha pasyato muni.
That which is night to all beings, in that the self-controlled man is awake. When all beings are awake, that is night for the sage who sees. So that's verse number 69, a very beautiful verse. I'll just repeat that meaning again if it was too short and you missed it. That which is night to all beings, in that the self-controlled man is awake. When all beings are awake, that is night for the sage who sees. So it's a very beautiful and cryptic verse. Here Krishna compares a person who is self-controlled, samyami, right, that's the word he uses, to the rest of the people, sarva bhutanam. And Krishna says, ya nisha, what is night, sarva bhutanam, for all other living beings, tasyam jagartim, in that is wakeful, samyami, the self-controlled. So Krishna says, what is night for all beings, right? He's not saying for the other human beings or for the human beings who are not self-controlled. He says, sarva bhutanam, which means he's saying that for all the others, he's putting the self-control, the samyami in one, in one module, and the rest of the world, be it other human beings and other animals and all of that in one bucket. Why does he do that? One interpretation to this could probably be that a human being who goes with the senses is in no way different from an animal that follows its instincts, right? And that is why he's saying that sarva bhutanam, if you're a human being but you're still going completely following your senses, then you fall in the category of all other living beings. And when he says darkness and sleep, in this particular line, it represents ignorance or lack of awareness. So what Krishna means when he says that the self-controlled man is awake when the rest are asleep, it means he is in full awareness when it comes to the purpose of life or when it comes to being conscious of the self within. All others are in dark, but he is awake. All others are asleep to this reality within, but he is awake and he is aware about that, right? You could say that sleep also represents a state of having lesser control than when awake, right? That's what happens when I go to sleep. If a thief comes into my room and starts picking things that are lying around me, I will not be aware of it. So it is a state of being less conscious or less alert to what is happening around. But wakefulness is a state where one lives consciously, not merely being dragged by the senses and desires, but lives consciously and takes control of one's life. So in situations when a worldly person is vulnerable, the wise man is firm and alert, is another way we can look at. Where others are being dragged around, he does not get dragged around. He's not pliable. He stands there and says that, no, I will have my way. Similarly, he says, yasyam jagrati bhutani, when all other beings are asleep, sa nisha, that is night, pasyato munehe, for the sage who sees. And in this line, when you say night or when you say sleep, it is not a reference to ignorance, but being unaffected. And we had spoken about this, I think, when we were talking about the senses being unaffected. One of the places where our senses are absolutely unaffected is when we are asleep, right? unless we are Kumbhakarna and the aroma of freshly cooked food wakes us up, right? Otherwise, even that kind of aroma will never wake us up when we are in deep sleep. So here, when Krishna is referring to sleep, yasyam jagrati bhutani, sa nisha pashyato munehe. In the second line, nisha or night or sleep is not a reference to ignorance, but a reference to being unaffected by that which drags us out, right? Krishna has spoken of a state where one has no taste, no rasa at all for worldly pleasures. That is what is being referred to here. So when others are alert or when others' senses are excited, the muni or a sage sees nothing there, right? He is not at all affected by what is affecting the others. And it is very beautiful usage of words. Krishna says, sa nisha pashyato munihi. Pashyato means the one who sees. So he is saying that he is not able to see the sense objects because he sees. Right? That's the beautiful way it is put. He is not able to see the sense objects. He is asleep when it comes to the sense objects. He is in darkness when it comes to the sense objects because he is a seer. Because he is able to see, he is blinded when it comes to the sense objects coming to attract him, right? It's a very, very beautiful way of putting it. And in fact, there's a wonderful Chinnakatha which Swami would say, which I'm sure most of you may be aware of, where there is this couple who decide to renounce life, and the husband comes home and he says that, you know, we'll have to pursue our spiritual path and let's give up everything and let's take to the spiritual path. So the wife is also of a similar nature. She is also spiritual minded and she tells the husband, yes, we should do that. And so they completely leave everything. They just, with the clothes that they're wearing, they don't take anything with them. They say, we'll just go to the forest and we'll live there, lives of a renunciant. Right? And as they are going through, forests and woods and all of that, at one particular point, Swami says that the husband sees that in the ground, somebody has dropped by mistake a gold ornament or a gold plate. I don't know exactly what Swami says in that Chinnakatha. Something of value, right? Something made of gold is there. Let's say a gold plate is there. So the moment the husband sees this, he wonders that if my wife happens to see this gold plate, will her focus in the spiritual path get disturbed, right? So he, when the wife is not exactly noticing what he is doing, what he does is very silently, Swami says that he kicks some sand so that the sand covers that gold plate and that does not fall in the eyes of the wife. And the wife notices what he was doing. She just sees that this is what he's doing. And then she reprimands the husband. She tells the husband, so you still have this distinction that this is sand and that is gold. She says that for me, that gold was also sand. The sand was also sand, right? You have given up everything, but still you hold that distinction in your mind. Because you hold it in your mind, you are trying to hide it from me, right? Because the wife was able to see the gold also as dust, just like how the sand is dust. She was going to be blind to the attraction that the gold will otherwise create in a person, right? The husband might not have got disturbed or attracted to the gold, but he really saw that gold as gold and the sand as sand, and that's why he was trying to cover it up with the sand. But the one who sees, Pashyate Munihi, that's what he says, Pashyate Munihi, the one who is able to see the sand also as sand, the gold also as sand, will not see the gold as gold, right? If I could put it that way. So when Krishna says that the person who is self-controlled, the person who is a sthita prajna, is asleep or is in night when everybody else is awake, when everybody else's senses are stirred when a certain thing happens, that does not affect this person at all. So that's the beautiful 69th verse, very cryptically and very beautifully explained this whole process of the distinction between a worldly person and a person who is established in the self. So with that, dear listeners, it's time for me to wrap up this week's program. I'll join you all again next week, 7:30 p.m. for the continuation of this. And probably we should be completing the second chapter with next week's episode. And after that, probably as I mentioned to you, we should have a summary of the second chapter, because so much was said in this. I'm not saying this because you need a summary. I'm saying this because I need a summary. It would really be helpful to me to go back to this and completely get a comprehensive idea of what Swami has said through the second chapter. And I think that's what we will do. If you have any other thoughts, if you have a summary that you want to share with me and probably help me out in this, that would be lovely. You can send me your feedback either personally to me, or you can send it to listener@radiosai.org. We could probably work together and create a summary, so that, more importantly, as I keep repeating again and again, we have to be able to take out practical lessons from this. What can I start doing in my life from today, right? Otherwise, it's quite meaningless, right? And that's what will happen. Tomorrow, some disaster will happen in life and we'll wonder, where did all that gyan that we heard go? Where did all the wisdom that I heard through the discourses and through the readings go? Right? Unless we start practicing it in everyday life, it will not be with us when we need it. Right? So that's what we'll try to do, but that's not next week. That'll be probably the week after that. If you have anything to share, you can send it to listener@radiosai.org. If you have any quick comments to make, you can also send it to our WhatsApp feedback number. That is 9393258258. I'll repeat that again. 9393258258. I'll join you all again next week for the continuation of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of the Race Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. Happy listening.
listening to Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay tuned.